Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with an analysis of the most powerful man in Washington who is not the president, Senator Joe Manchin, and speak with Alice Koch, an investigative reporter and editor at the Center for Media and Democracy, about his article at The Guardian, "The Democrat Blocking Progressive Change is Beholden to Big Oil. Surprised?" We'll discuss the conflict of interest in having Manchin chair the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee while owning a coal brokerage company, Enosystems, his son runs, that paid him $500,000 in 2020, in which he has $5 million worth of stock. With the bipartisan infrastructure bill likely to collapse in tomorrow's Senate vote, we'll assess whether the Democrats can work around Manchin's objections to moving to cleaner energy to address climate change in the budget reconciliation bill that could grow to $4 trillion if Republicans back away from the bipartisan deal. We'll also discuss whether the Democrats should give in to Manchin and his version of the For the People Act or end up with nothing. Then we'll speak with Jamie Beck Alexander, director of Drawdown Labs at Project Drawdown, a nonprofit dedicated to using existing solutions to stop global warming. With much of the West in flames early in the fire season and areas of California running out of water, we will discuss her article at CNN, "Seeking Your Climate Refuge? Consider This." Then finally, with Facebook banning the QAnon congresswoman because of her fact-free anti-vaxxing advice, we will look into how tech platforms are overwhelmed by this new form of propaganda that has enlisted us all as propagandists. Times have changed since Noam Chomsky wrote about the manufacturing of consent, which elites thought was necessary because they believed, quoting Chomsky, "the mass of the public are just too stupid to be able to understand things. We have to tame the bewildered herd, not allow the bewildered herd to rage and trample and destroy things." Jennifer Machia, professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University and the author of Demagogue for President, The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump, joins us to discuss her article at The Conversation, "We Are All Propagandists Now," and how, as we saw on January the 6th, the bewildered herd is now out of the gate and in a rage as they trample and destroy things. And before we begin, as the toxic cloud of the tragic Trump years lifts and we gear up to rebuild our broken country and heal our endangered world, we at Background Briefing will soon have to rely on your support at backgroundbriefing.org/donate to keep broadcasting on affiliates and online at backgroundbriefing.org, as either the Pacifica Network goes bankrupt or the dysfunctional and destructive Pacifica boards take Background Briefing off the air in retaliation for my advocacy for professional management and financial transparency. When we move fully to online broadcasting, we will be depending on you, our growing global and national community of listeners, to sustain us for as little as $5 a month to keep this program independent, corporate-free, and accessible to those not in a position to contribute at backgroundbriefing.org/donate. And I thank you for your support. And joining us now is Alice Koch, who's an investigative reporter and editor with the Center for Media and Democracy, a nationally recognized watchdog that leads award-winning investigations into corruption that undermines our democracy, environment, and economic prosperity. And he has an article at The Guardian, "The Democrats Blocking Progressive Change is Beholden to Big Oil. Surprised?" Welcome to Background Briefing, Alex Koch.
Thanks a lot. Glad to be back.
Well, thanks for joining us, Alex. And the Democrat who's blocking the progressive change in the Senate, who's beholden to Big Oil, is, surprise, surprise, Joe Manchin, right?
That's right. He is beholden to Big Oil and to the mining industry, and has actually personally invested heavily in coal. And so that was part of the thrust of my Guardian piece, was that he's financially conflicted as well as heavily influenced by, you know, big oil and gas.
And what is exactly the size and scope of his holdings, particularly in coal?
Yeah, so, and he actually is the founder of a coal supplier called Enosystems, which delivers coal to utility companies in West Virginia. And that was founded in about 1988. And, you know, he has since become a politician and kind of handed the reins over to his son. But it's a family business. It's a private company. And he owns between $1 and $5 million worth of stock in the company. But I should, you know, the real context here is not, you know, this is a, I think, bad in its own right. You know, U.S. Senator having a financial stake in a major industry that we should be shutting down over the next decade. Is that he is the chair of the Senate Energy and Natural Resources Committee, and he was the ranking member when the Republicans had the majority. So he is impacting legislation, in fact, controlling the Senate legislation on the fossil fuels and natural resources, while having a personal financial stake in the health of the coal industry. And then in terms of my piece, this is discussing the federal budget, which is now in negotiations. Democrats are kind of negotiating with each other to figure out a budget bill that they're going to pass through reconciliation, and Manchin wants to cut the climate provisions.
But you mentioned that his business supplying coal to electrical generators, and I believe coal, even though it was in decline, is making a slight comeback. And a lot of utilities companies now are, in fact, going back to coal because the price of natural gas has risen. But tell me about why his company is failing.
I actually am not really familiar with that. I think Sludge, where he formerly worked, had a recent piece about Enersystems Systems and sort of a connected company, but I'm not actually really, I have not reported on that myself.
Right. But they're reporting that he's not doing well, even though he's got $5 million worth of stock.
Okay. I mean, it's not surprising. I guess there might be this little coal resurgence. I don't think it's going to last very long. Coal was
Right.
kind of on the way out already, but he's one of the most powerful people in politics in the United States, and probably actually the most powerful person in Washington, I think, in large part because Joe Biden is not pressuring him to relent and to help him with his agenda. So, the fact that, you know, this man who's one of the most powerful politicians in America has a vested interest, a financial conflict of interest in keeping and improving perhaps the coal industry as opposed to helping shut it down. While we have wildfires engulfing the West Coast, we have floods, biblical level floods in Belgium and Germany right now. It's never been more obvious that climate change is a disaster and is incredibly dangerous.
And recently we learned from the Texas Tribune that Joe Manchin had attended a Texas fundraiser hosted by major Republican donors and mostly from the oil and gas industry.
That's right.
So has there been any subsequent reporting? I mean, presumably Manchin must have seen all the reports about it. He didn't publicize the fact that he was going to Texas after having met with the Democratic Texas legislators who fled to stop this dreadful voting bill in the Texas legislature. They all met with Manchin, but the next day he went off to Texas for this fundraiser. So, have you heard anything since from Manchin?
I haven't seen him comment on that, unless something came out very recently, like today. But yeah, he was meeting with Richard Kinder, the head of Kinder Morgan. A lot of major fossil fuel companies, oil and gas companies, executives were there, presumably to give him money and to praise him and to urge him to continue to block important climate change legislation. And it's even more egregious by what you mentioned, because the whole, essentially, I think the whole caucus of Democrats in one of their state houses, it was, I think their representatives went to DC to plead with Biden and Joe Manchin to get rid of the filibuster for voting rights legislation so they can pass the For the People Act, which is HR1 and S1, and also the John Lewis Act, which would help restore part of the Voting Rights Act. And Manchin, he told them, no, I'm not willing to scrap the filibuster for anything. And then, of course, promptly went down to meet with Republican oil billionaires. So, if you know, there isn't really a more clear picture of who are Manchin's true constituents and who he really cares about.
And again, I'm speaking with Alex Koch, who's an investigative reporter and editor with the Center for Media and Democracy, a nationally recognized watchdog that leads award-winning investigations into the corruption that undermines our democracy, environment, and economic prosperity. And he has an article at The Guardian, "The Democrat Blocking Progressive Change is Beholden to Big Oil, Surprised." So we're going to learn tomorrow whether the Senate Republicans are going to stick with their version of the infrastructure bill, the bipartisan version. If there's some indications that, well, we know that Republican activists are spending money against particularly Jerry Moran in Kansas to try and peel him off and others. Manchin and Sinema, of course, were a part of that bipartisan group. What's your sense, Alex, whether or not that bill's going to collapse?
It seems like it already has to me. And, you know, the tragic thing is that, you know, Biden agreed to this and probably was quite supportive of the idea of a bipartisan infrastructure bill. And then the idea was that the Democrats would pass other things that couldn't make it into that bill in the budget through reconciliation. And so Manchin quickly stripped all of the climate provisions from Biden's initial infrastructure package, because the understanding was that they would go into the budget, and now he's trying to strip them from the budget. So he actually wants no climate action whatsoever. And you know, again, it's on President Biden to pressure him and get Chuck Schumer to pressure him, threaten him with his committee chairmanship, with his caucus membership. Even, I mean, we don't have time. We really don't have any more time. We actually are in borrowed time already to fix the climate. We can see what's happening. And so if Biden doesn't step up, then I'm not really sure he'll have any kind of legacy.
Right. But if this bipartisan bill collapses tomorrow, then would that then give impetus to passing the reconciliation bill, the bigger one, the $3.5 trillion?
Maybe.
I mean, how could Manchin object to that, since it was the Republicans who have stymied all of these bipartisan deals, whether it's the bipartisan investigation into January the 6th and everything else they've stopped. And that's the nature of the filibuster. So
Yeah. They
had this meeting. They got 11 Republicans on board. And if they all walk away, surely Manchin doesn't really have a case about bipartisanship anymore, does he?
Oh, no. And look, Manchin he's not stupid. He knows what he's doing. There's no way he doesn't realize that this bill isn't going to pass. I mean, they can only afford to have one or two Republicans walk away and it's done. I think that's already basically clear that that's going to happen. So even though this guy has been a bipartisan lawmaker his whole career, I don't think he truly actually thinks this is going to happen. So, but here's the thing, it's a win-win for him either way, because if he gets the bipartisan thing, he's happy, Joe Biden's happy, great. If he doesn't, he can basically rewrite the entire budget. And Kyrsten Sinema will probably follow suit. So he kind of wins either way. And, you know, unfortunately, the country and the planet are going to suffer.
So there's no way for Biden and Schumer to negotiate with Manchin on the $3.5 trillion infrastructure bill, which would get bigger because you've got $579 billion in the bipartisan bill that's likely to collapse tomorrow. So it could get up to $4 trillion. I mean, he needs, in West Virginia, they desperately need broadband and other services that could be a part of a boondoggle package for West Virginia, surely.
Yeah, I mean, they can negotiate with him, but they've been, you know, allegedly negotiating with him for months already, and he hasn't budged on the filibuster. He hasn't budged on climate stuff. So I don't know. With their current kind of softball tactics with Manchin, he's basically running the government. If they want to actually play hardball, which they absolutely need to, I think they can extract a lot from him. But I think they really have to be actual politicians. They have to look back to LBJ and to presidents like that who were able to strong arm their caucus to pass important legislation. And they have to say, Manchin, we're gonna kick you off your energy committee if you don't comply with us. We need to have a victory or two, or we're gonna lose the next election. And you know, while Manchin will still be powerful as a swing vote, the entire Democratic Party will be out of power for years, and there's going to be no hope of fixing the climate, no hope of any kind of semblance of adequate voting rights for marginalized people in America. It's going to be complete and utter disaster.
Well, I think it's pretty clear that Manchin uses the filibuster, and both he and Sinema's justification for the filibuster. She wrote an op-ed in the Washington Post recently that made absolutely no sense. Their justifications for keeping the filibuster are just so thin, they're specious, and I think they probably are just hiding behind that so that they don't have to admit that they're really basically dancing to the tune of the donors, particularly the oil and gas donors, that Manchin met with the other day in Texas. So, but if they push him real hard, can't he walk across the aisle and then suddenly Mitch McConnell is the majority leader?
I've thought about that. I kind of doubt that Manchin, you know, having been a long, you know, a career Democrat, would want to actually join the GOP caucus, the caucus of Trump. I think that'd be highly embarrassing for him. But I really don't know what his endgame is. I mean, if because the thing is, you know, he, as you say, he and Sinema are using the filibuster to make themselves a little bit more powerful. They're still powerful because of the 50-50 split. But if Democrats pick up two seats and they get rid of the filibuster, they'll be irrelevant because Democrats will have 51 with Harris, and then they'll be completely irrelevant and they'll have no say. So the filibuster is incredibly important for their power, and it's really cynical what they're doing with it, lying about it, and just ignoring the fact that the filibuster was largely used as a tool of white supremacists in the 20th century to block legislation on civil rights and things like that. So I don't think he's going to the GOP caucus, but you know, I'm kind of increasingly thinking that, you know, the only way for him to flip is either extreme pressure from Schumer and Biden, of course, or a series of many different votes on all these bills and have him on the record voting against, you know, every progressive bill there is, and basically blocking the Democratic agenda. And maybe something will happen with activist groups on the left to kind of pressure him, because right now he's getting a lot of pressure and praise from right wing groups. Americans for Prosperity, which is the main Charles Koch funded political advocacy organization, has been running Facebook ads, paid ads, thanking him for essentially blocking the Biden agenda. It's gotten to that point where he is getting plaudits from the far right. You know, and I think the left has been certainly responsive to his inadequacies, but the sort of center left, the sort of liberal advocacy groups could probably step it up quite a bit.
So given that Manchin has this extraordinary power because of the narrow majority the Democrats have in the Senate, and he's obviously aware of it, and to a lesser extent I think Sinema is as well, although she is a co-sponsor of the For the People Act. Now, is there a way then to basically do a compromise with Manchin on the infrastructure bill, which could be as big as $4 trillion, if the bipartisan bill collapses, which it's likely to do? Could you then basically say to Manchin, look, we'll give in to you on the voting rights? And because Manchin put forth a voting rights package that has some good stuff in it, like making a voting day a federal holiday, which is I think would make a huge difference to turnout. It wasn't obviously all the things that the For the People Act want, but it's not too bad, and it would actually pass and get something done. So are we at a point where you got to get something done as opposed to nothing, which is what we're heading towards, both on voting rights and on infrastructure?
Yeah, I'm not sure Manchin is interested in anything really changing. I mean, that's kind of the definition of conservative, right? He's the most conservative Democrat in the Senate. But, you know, Biden and them, they could have used that bill, the kind of basically the rewrite that Manchin did, and held it and withheld their support. But they almost immediately backed it. They just completely capitulated to Manchin and said, oh, this is great, let's do it. And then they still had the problem that he opposes the filibuster, so his own bill is not going to pass. They could have withheld that and then, as you say, used it later or now to say, okay, we'll give you your version of this voting rights bill, but you have to come along and, you know, pass our big reconciliation budget. I mean, that's okay, but, you know, they didn't do that. They have not been tactical whatsoever. And I think it's pretty clear to your listeners that I've been frustrated about this for a long time. It's hard to describe how poorly I think Biden is managing this. If he wants a legacy, he has to pass legislation that's not the Recovery Act. I mean, he could be like Trump, where there's one piece of legislation in his first term that's of any import. And that's not good. It's not good for the party. It's not good for his reelection chances. And it's just not good for anyone.
So given the power that Manchin has and the fact that, well, I mean, the infrastructure bill, there's at least some interest, some bipartisan interest, even if it's likely to collapse. On the voting rights, it's clear right across the board that not one Republican wants to go along with it. And that that includes people like Mitt Romney. They honestly, the GOP, they're not just in the thrall of Trump. They're also in lockstep behind the idea that they'd rather cheat than compete. And they have absolutely outrageous and comprehensive levels of voter suppression going on, where before a vote is cast in 2022, they will pick up the House through gerrymandering. And then on voting day, they'll have all kinds of voting suppression in important states. And then after that, the Republican legislatures will then get to count and certify the vote. And if they don't like it, they can change it. And then the other aspect of the voter suppression onslaught is that the traditionally neutral poll workers are being purged now and threatened, and half of them feel threatened, according to a recent poll, and they're quitting in droves, and they're being replaced by the lunatic fringe of the GOP, like these cyber ninjas in Arizona with that bogus recount. So this is the ultimate threat to American democracy. So I don't understand how anybody, let alone Joe Manchin, cannot recognize the writing on the wall that you're going to lose in 2022 and 2024 because the decks are stacked against you. And how could you accept that?
Yeah, I mean, and I wrote a pretty long piece for Exposed by CMD about the GOP's plot to steal the next elections and the ones after that. But the thing about Manchin is he gets a lot of conservative votes. I think he's one of the only Democrats who would probably not be hurt by these voting restrictions all going into place around the country. And he clearly doesn't care about the future of his party. I think he's basically kind of an independent with a D next to his name. But on the complete other side of that spectrum, that Bernie Sanders is, who is an independent, but he caucuses with Democrats. He doesn't really, I think he's not, he doesn't really care who's in power. He just wants to remain powerful in his perch. And so he's willing to block voting rights legislation that is absolutely essential, as you describe, to prevent all this awful GOP election theft that's just ramping up in ways that I don't think we've seen since Jim Crow, and that Biden has acknowledged that we haven't seen since Jim Crow. They're going to take over secretaries of state, the far right fringe, Stop the Steal people. They're going to take over secretaries of state offices, which control elections. They're taking over local elections boards. The state lawmakers are passing bills that allow them to, appoint all members of these elections boards instead of sort of a bipartisan commission or people from both parties selecting them. So it is an absolute crisis for our democracy. And if there's no urgency now, like I don't know what to say. I think, you know, again, Biden has a couple months to do this or it's over.
Well, but Alex, Manchin has a huge stake, and so does Sinema, in the 2022 elections, because if through voter suppression and these other changes with the ability to count the vote, and we've seen that bill first passed down in Georgia, where Raffensperger, who did the right thing in the last election, now he's out of it, and the legislature then decides they get to count and certify the vote. So I think it's guaranteed almost that Raphael Warnock is going to lose in 2022 because he's only got 2 years to fill out of that seat that he won. So that'll put the Democrats back in the minority, just a loss of that one seat, and Mitch McConnell will be in charge, and Joe Manchin will be in the minority, which is no fun. So will Sinema. So I would think for that reason alone, they wouldn't want it to happen.
Yeah, I mean, I think you're right. It's a little bit better for him if the Democrats have the slight majority versus the Republicans. But he'll still be working with them on stuff. I mean, does McConnell completely get rid of the filibuster? He got rid of it for Supreme Court picks so he could get all three of Trump's nominees on the court. He will do whatever is best for his power in the party. But he didn't completely scrap it. So if there's the filibuster still, at least for a little while at the beginning of, let's say, a GOP-led Senate, Manchin still has a pretty similar position of power. And again, that's probably one of the reasons he opposes it now, is because if it does flip back, which is likely, that's the only way he'll have any power under McConnell.
Well, just in closing, Alex, tell us about opt-out that you've founded. And give us a description of what you're trying to do.
Yeah, thanks for asking. Opt-out is a forthcoming news app for independent media exclusively. Financially independent, ethical, accurate outlets all under one roof, where you can get articles, podcasts, and videos right on your phone or your tablet or the web app, which is going to come out later. And I'm glad that Background Briefing was one of the first outlets to join the network. And we're going to have that app out probably in beta form, a limited beta release in September for iPhone. And then we're going to spend a few months beta testing and have it out in January for the masses. And then we'll after that, we'll have the Android app and a tablet app and then a web app. So we are run by a nonprofit charity that I co-founded with Walker Bragman, another independent journalist, called the Opt Out Media Foundation. And we're raising money now to convert a largely volunteer operation of developers, tech developers, and news curators, and other staff to a paid staff. So you can find out more at optout.news is our website, and that'll link you to our newsletter as well, our free weekly newsletter with completely independent content every week.
Well, Alex Koch, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Oh, thanks so much. Anytime.
And again, I've been speaking with Alex Koch, who's an investigative reporter and editor with the Center for Media and Democracy, a nationally recognized watchdog that leads award-winning investigations into the corruption that undermines our democracy, environment, and economic prosperity. And he has an article in The Guardian, "The Democrat Blocking Progressive Change is Beholden to Big Oil. Surprised?" We're going to take a brief station break. We're back looking into how the West is in flames early in the fire season and areas of California running out of water, and how some Californians are seeking climate refuge.
At least it's not the end of the world.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jamie Beck-Alexander, director of the Drawdown Lab at Project Drawdown, a nonprofit dedicated to using existing solutions to stop global warming. Previously, she served as a civil and foreign service officer with the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, implementing projects to combat malaria and other infectious diseases, serving in Bangladesh, India, and Tanzania, and has also worked with the UN Office of the Secretary General. And she has an article at CNN, "Seeking Your Climate Refuge, Consider This." Welcome to Background Briefing, Jamie Beck-Alexander.
Thank you for having me.
Well, thanks for joining us. And you moved from California because of the fires that turned the air in San Francisco red, where you and your children were, and obviously was very unhealthy. My daughter teaches at Stanford, so she lives up near Stanford, and I was visiting at that time, and it was pretty horrible even there. So it was incredibly bad in San Francisco itself, and now you're in Duluth, Minnesota. And ironically, of course, the bad air from the fires in Canada are affecting you there. But just in terms of having the West on fire and California last year, and obviously it's going to be bad this year, and Oregon now has a huge fire that's burned an area much greater than Los Angeles itself. The tragedy is, in terms of global warming, is the trees that are burned are the ones that give us oxygen. And when they burn, they pollute the air, which contributes to global warming and deny us the lungs of the earth, if you will. So this is a self-reinforcing nightmare, is it not?
That's right. Unfortunately, I mean, the you know, at Project Drawdown, where I work, we look at all of the things that influence the amount of greenhouse gases in the atmosphere. And according to our analysis, you know, previous to the last year's fire season, trees and natural climate solutions like trees and mangroves and coastal ecosystems absorb about 30% of the greenhouse gas emissions that human beings put into the atmosphere every year. So nature, including trees, are a huge carbon sink for us, and they do this incredible work for us. So the more that they burn and send yet more emissions into the atmosphere, the harder our job is going to be, because we don't have nature doing that absorption of greenhouse gases for us. So unfortunately, it makes the hard work of reducing emissions immediately that much more important and that much harder to do.
And as I mentioned, your article points out that last year they broke records in the state of California with 4 million acres burned. And this year, according to data from CAL FIRE, is on track to be even worse. And along with losing our forests and polluting the air even more, we're also experiencing record droughts in the state of California, and water has run out in rural towns in the Central Valley. So, of course, water being necessary to put out the fires in itself is scarce. So we're sort of describing a bit of a nightmare scenario here. So tell us about your decision to move to Duluth.
Yeah. Well, we, after going through the 2018 campfire, which was, I think still the most destructive fire in California's history, that was really a turning point for my family. We all had, negative impacts, and some of them have lingered for my kids. And we just, at that, I think that was really the turning point. And then as the pandemic hit and the fires that, our drought last year was looking like last year was going to be another bad wildfire season. We kind of said, let's start looking at where we can really put down roots in a new community and, and invest in the local community and really plan for our lives as a family together. So we just, I think Duluth has come up in certain circles as potentially having some attributes that make it a little more, perhaps climate resilient, having fresh water in Lake Superior, having a climate forward sort of, local government, local leadership, but really climate, that wasn't really top of mind for us. We were sort of just intending to really go away for the summer for the wildfire season and then come back. But then based on how awful of a wildfire season last year was, we decided to stay. And, and I think there is no way of picking up one city or one part of the globe and separating it from the global system. I mean, the earth is one system. What happens in one place reverberates and has effects in another place. And so Duluth is not a climate haven. There are no climate havens. I think that's sort of what we've learned. I mean, we're here today, with unhealthy air quality, 150, AQI, which is in the unhealthy category for a week now from the fires in Canada. So I think, the lesson for us and the lesson that I think, I was trying to get across in my piece was there is no getting away from climate change. The only getting away from climate change comes from reducing emissions, not from running away from it and giving up.
And again, I'm speaking with Jamie Beck-Alexander, the director of Drawdown Labs at Project Drawdown, a nonprofit dedicated to using existing solutions to stop global warming. Previously, she served as a civil and foreign service officer with the U.S. Agency for International Development, USAID, implementing projects to combat malaria and other infectious diseases, serving in Bangladesh, India, and Tanzania. And she's also worked with the UN Office of the Secretary General. And she has an article at CNN, Seeking Your Climate Refuge, Consider This. And of course, as you say in your article, we are at a pivotal moment in human and planetary history. And the question for us cannot be, where might I be safe? But also, where might I be of most use? So tell us about what you consider to be what we can do in the face of watching our planet burn and our politicians dither.
Yeah. Well, I think first, it's it's human nature to want to do all we can to keep ourselves and our families and our communities safe, or as safe, or do all, you know, do all that in our power that we can to keep ourselves safe. That's understandable. That's a, you know, that's human nature. And I think we have an opportunity here where people are being, you know, radicalized, I think, to the climate crisis in real time. I mean, people are in droves are beginning to, you know, see that this is real, that it's now, that it's an emergency, that it's, you know, that it affects everything that we know and love. And so I think there's an opportunity now to bring people along on, you know, I call it going through the wormhole, where you like, you go through this process of realizing, oh, wow, this is the reality that we're living in. And sometimes it takes, you know, going through a natural disaster or, you know, traumatizing experience like a wildfire to realize that. And so I think the more that we can, as people go through that process of becoming, you know, attuned to where we are in time and in terms of the climate crisis, the more that we can, you know, sort of equip them to take action, to use that realization to change, you know, to put that to work, and not just shy away from it, not just try to, you know, feel guilty about it and be silent about it, but to be, you know, open about it, to talk about it, to say, I'm, you know, hey, I'm thinking about moving because of climate change, because this is how urgent the issue is. I think we need, this is something that we need to talk about. It can't be something that just the people that are in the know or that have the means to do it should do. You know, I mean, I think the more we talk about it, the more we educate others, the more we acknowledge that this is where we are right now in this moment in planetary history, that we can bring others along. We can bring this to our, you know, the communities that people are, you know, that people are moving to, and we can bring others in powerful ways. And so I think that the most important thing that I've found in making this move was to engage locally, and to not be silent about it, and to try to the more we talk about it, the more real it becomes, and the more we can act on it.
Well, you write in your article at CNN, Jamie Beck Alexander, seeking your climate refuge, consider this, that to ensure that your climate-related move doesn't exacerbate existing inequality, climate migration risks deepening class divides, disrupting local cultures, and furthering a history of colonization. When my family relocated to Duluth, Minnesota, the most valuable advice we received came from Karen Diver, a former tribal leader of the Fond du Lac Band of Lake Superior Chippewa, the original caretakers of the place we now call home. She said to us, don't let your climate solution result in our spiritual and cultural genocide. So that, of course, is the dilemma. How do you move from where you are to where you think you've been safer, but not turn where you think you're safer into what you've escaped from? Is that your dilemma?
Right. I think that very much is the dilemma, and talking about it and, you know, planning for it as much as we can, is one way I think that we can, you know, that we can treat this with as much thoughtfulness and sensitivity as possible. I mean, these communities here in Duluth have gone, you know, have been colonized once, and they, you know, see this as the potential for being colonized yet again by people with means who come here from other, you know, coastal cities that are seeing more of the impacts. And so, I mean, I've seen that already since in the last few months. Our housing prices here in Duluth have skyrocketed. People from out of town, you know, anecdotally I've heard are putting in bids well above asking price without ever seeing the house, and, you know, buying property here. And there's really a sense of, you know, that people are going to be moving here, seeing this as some sort of refuge, and not engaging and skewing the local culture and the local economy and exacerbating the existing inequity in every American city. So engaging, I think, I mean, Karen, who the person that you quoted, Karen, read my piece before I was drafting it. And, I think one very important thing is to acknowledge and to learn about the history of the land that you live on or that you're thinking about living on. Understand, who are the original caretakers of that land. For us, it's the Ojibwe and the Chippewa. And understanding that history and understanding local issues and ways to engage, supporting local, environmental justice and social justice movements here and local organizations. I think all of and bringing your skills and expertise to support this community, I think are things that I've learned can begin to help with that. But I think one of the reasons that I really wanted to write this piece again is because I feel like a lot of this is happening in silence, and I've been contacted dozens of times by people in California saying, I want to move. Should I move to Duluth? Do you have a real estate agent? And I think the more that we raise this as a conversation, a global conversation, that we're all facing this together at different levels of privilege. But we need to talk about it, or else it will create exacerbated inequity. And it's something that I think is critically important that we get right.
So just in the last couple of minutes, Jamie Beck Alexander, obviously this is a complicated issue, and you've really educated us, I think, on a lot of what you've gone through and what the issues are here. And of course, we have in this country, whenever we have crises, people buy guns. I mean, there's this tendency to hunker down and to, become survivalists and basically hoard and, forget about your neighbors. But you're really arguing here that this is a moment to align your life with this new reality of climate change and become an activist. Is that right?
I think that's exactly right. I mean, I think you did just paint the possibilities that, like, either we all retreat into our own, cocoons and try to shore up our own resilience for ourselves and, buy up stocks of, air purifiers and the guns, God forbid, just shore up our own means to deal with the crises that are coming, or we kind of open ourselves up, engage deeply, build deep community, build deep roots in these places, commit to bringing everyone along, and go on this journey together, and have the ability to lean on one another and to look out for one another and to have support systems in the face of all that's here and what's ahead. I think those are the two those are two different possibilities. And I certainly want to be a part of the latter, where you exist in a deeply rooted community of people who care for one another, who look out for one another, who share resources, who share knowledge, who build resilience together, and who work to address the roots of the crisis at the same time. And so that's the future that I want to build, and that I hope we can move toward together as a global community.
Well, Jamie Beck Alexander, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
And again, I've been speaking with Jamie Beck Alexander, who is the director of Drawdown Labs at Project Drawdown, a nonprofit dedicated to using existing solutions to stop global warming. Previously, she served as a civil and foreign service officer with the United States Agency of International Development, USAID, implementing projects to combat malaria and other infectious diseases, serving in Bangladesh, India, and Tanzania. And she's also worked with the UN Office of the Secretary General. And she has an article at CNN, Seeking Your Climate Refuge, Consider This. We can take a brief station break and back looking into how times have changed since Noam Chomsky wrote about the manufacturing consent. Now, as the bewildered herd is out of the gate and in a rage as they trample and destroy things.
I don't want to set the world on fire. I just want to start a flame in your heart. In my
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Jennifer Machia, who's a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, an historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. She's the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency, and the author of Founding Fictions, as well as Demagogue for President, The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump. And she also has an article at The Conversation, We Are All Propagandists Now. Welcome to Background Briefing, Jennifer Machia.
It's my pleasure. Thank you for having me on today.
Well, thanks for joining us, Jennifer. And tell us why we are all propagandists, because as a journalist, that's about the last thing I want to be called.
Well, journalists probably aren't propagandists now, at least not in the sense that I mean.
Well, maybe on Fox News they are.
Well, maybe we wouldn't call those journalists. maybe we would. So I've been writing a book about propaganda, and what I've realized is that the old, you know, manufacturing consent model of propaganda that Herman and Chomsky famously, you know, explained in the 1980s, but that emerged actually during World War I, that model, you know, is still in existence, of course, but that it's in a lot of ways been replaced. And I think that probably you can mark it to the 2008 presidential election. That's when social media had diffused through enough of the population that the Obama campaign used community organizing strategies online very successfully. And they were able to, you know, turn their supporters into advocates for the campaign. And so, you know, from that start, you see it increase. In 2011, right, we have all of these revolutions and near revolutions around the world that are linked to social media use, right? And you see the real democratic potential of social media. And I think about that time is probably when, you know, some really savvy conservatives realized that they could harness the power of social media to manufacture dissent rather than consent. And it's a project that's been ongoing on the right, really since the 1990s, but probably reached its apex, you know, with the 2016 campaign and following. And so what I see today is, you know, an information war essentially being played out among the American electorate by all of us, right? Where we all have access to the public sphere, but we don't know news values. You know, we're not trained as journalists. We don't know, you know, communication ethics. We don't know, you know, the ethics that political, professional political communicators use when they work on campaigns. You know, so we've been turned loose to communicate with each other and to try to persuade each other. But rather than persuasion, we use propaganda primarily.
And it seems like the only arbitrator there is are these big tech platforms like Facebook. They just deplatformed Marjorie Taylor Greene, the QAnon congresswoman, because of her irresponsible and outrageous attacks on vaccination and encouraging people not to get vaccinated, which, by the way, the President of the United States has joined in. He's basically told his followers, and remember, he controls the Republican Party, so he has considerable number of followers, that you can't trust the government, you can't trust the Biden administration with vaccines. So this is, you know, obviously not adequate, having Facebook as your arbiter to stop really dangerous propaganda, if indeed you can grade propaganda itself. So what other mechanism should there be, Jennifer?
Well, so there, like you said, there is some of that on Facebook and other social media platforms of them policing content when it violates their terms of service. But, you know, there isn't enough of that. And in fact, the way that the platforms are designed, they are designed to encourage us to communicate as propagandists. So they've done their own internal research at Facebook, and researchers have done this outside of Facebook, and they've examined, you know, how people learn to post. So one study that Facebook did without letting its users know that they were doing this, they manipulated the emotional content that they were shown in their feeds. And so, you know, if they wanted to see, you know, if we could make people feel sad and post sad content by only showing them sad things, can we make them feel happy? Sure enough, they could. And they call that emotional contagion. And same thing with researchers outside of Facebook. They've done studies trying to see how is it that people learn, you know, what to post. And what they've said is that, you know, there's a social learning model basically that comes either from the app itself, right? So we get pinged in the dopamine receptors in our brains when we have the positive reinforcement that we get from notifications and likes and retweets and, you know, all of that. So that trains us, right, to do that, to do those things that are rewarded in that way. And then there's also social learning. So you learn from what your peers post to post content like that. And so what they found is that we learn to post outrageous and emotional, you know, content, things that outrage us, that will outrage others, because we learn to do that. We get all these, you know, recirculations and retweets and stuff. And we do that whether we feel outraged or not. We know that that is rewarded through the app and the platform. So it's actually in the infrastructure itself, right? You know, posting outrage and, you know, sort of that negative emotional contagion is a part of the problem of our public sphere. So, yeah, they do police some, right? But it's always too little and it's always too late. And so I don't know that their business model would allow them to do more, right? You know, and it doesn't seem like the government is very interested in figuring out ways to actually hold them accountable to what would be good for, you know, democracy and political discourse.
And of course, the conservatives in this country, the GOP and Trump and others, are claiming that we're all victims of cancel culture, that somehow right. The liberal elite is silencing and censoring them, when I haven't noticed that anybody has silenced Fox News or OAN and Newsmax and the Republicans in general. They seem to have a real knack for saying outrageous things to get headlines. And again, I'm speaking with Jennifer Machias, a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, an historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. She's the co-editor of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency, and the author of Founding Fictions, as well as Demagogue for President, The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump. And she has an article at The Conversation, We Are All Propagandists Now. So in your article, you talk about, and you mentioned him earlier, the linguist and social critic Noam Chomsky, who famously came up with the phrase, the manufacturer of consent. And he believed that the elites found it necessary because they thought, quoting Chomsky, the mass of the public are just too stupid to be able to understand things. We have to tame the bewildered herd, not allow the bewildered herd to rage and trample and destroy things. And it would seem now the opposite is true, that the conservative media in particular, in wanting their followers to own the libs and spreading all of this anti-COVID propaganda and all of this hate speech and encouraging these people to storm the Capitol, etc. Surely we are at a position now where, rather than tame the bewildered herd and not allow the bewildered herd to rage and trample and destroy, the intention is to rile up the base and have them rage and trample and destroy things, which is what happened on January the 6th.
That's exactly right. And just to go back to Chomsky, it was actually Walter Lippmann who coined the phrase, the manufacture of consent. And so when Herman and Chomsky and later in his own independent works, Chomsky is using that phrase, he's using it, quoting Lippmann and critiquing Lippmann for the work that he did to create propaganda in America. Lippmann and other intellectuals of the progressive era were very forthcoming about what they were doing, right? They were very clear that they needed to tame the bewildered herd, that the people were essentially dumb cows, that they couldn't be trusted, that they had to be led, and that they ought to be led through propaganda, public relations techniques. You know, all of that work of the early 20th century, you know, uses those kinds of terms and that kind of language that we would, you know, be surprised to read today. And so Chomsky was really paraphrasing Lippmann there. But yeah, I mean, it's absolutely what is going on right now in the right, right? Which is to say that they believe that politics is war, that the enemy cheats, and that the only solution is to rage and trample and destroy, right? That it's all phony, it's all corrupt, and all we need to do is set our people in motion on a continuous basis. And it's fascinating. If you look at, you know, the emails that they send, the news articles, you know, if you really sort of get into that media content, it's all positioning the audience members as, you know, a sort of army of of people who will spread their message, who will fight for their freedoms, you know, against this, you know, supposed conspiracy or this corruption or whatever it is. And it's absolutely about the manufacture of dissent. And the interesting thing is that just like the manufacture of consent, right, that is critiqued by Herman and Chomsky, is anti-democratic, right? It's not about actually consenting to the government and to the policies. It's about manufacturing that consent so that they believe something that they haven't reasoned through. They don't have good enough information to do that. It's a strategy of force and compliance gaining. The manufacture of dissent is the same thing. So it claims to be speaking the truth, right? And it positions itself against this, you know, propaganda model of the manufacture of consent, but it is absolutely propaganda itself. And the people who are dissenting from the government are dissenting on, you know, the basis of a lie, right? Based on force compliance, manipulation, conspiracy theory, all of these bad persuasion strategies, influence strategies. And, you know, it's just obviously destructive. I mean, we saw what can happen on January 6th.
So just in closing, Jennifer Mejia, it seems that what drives all of this, though, both on the left and the right, is a sense of alienation from the government. I mean, it's pretty clear that both the left and the right share this sense of alienation. It's particularly acute now on the right, of course, and particularly stoked by Trump, who is, according to General Milley, is following Hitler's playbook of being both the victim and the savior. And there's that sort of sense of alienation that something's been stolen from us and all of this stuff. But there's also on the left a sense that the government is thoroughly and irredeemably corrupt and controlled by a handful of guys in a back room, in a smoke-filled back room. So do we need to deal with the alienation in order to get to the point where we can start at least having some introduction of some form of critical thinking?
Absolutely. We need to deal with the problem of alienation. Loneliness is killing us. You know, people are susceptible to authoritarianism, to conspiracy theories, because they find community, you know, in participating when they believe, you know, they become heroic characters in the story. You know, distrust and cynicism has been on the rise in this country since the 1970s. And some of that is a product of this manufacture of dissent model, you know, that really emerged, you know, in some ways in the 1960s, right? You know, you can keep tracing it back further and further in making a case for, you know, sort of where it emerges from the beginning. But yeah, absolutely. So, you know, Robert Putnam wrote his book Bowling Alone right at the end of the 1990s, early 2000s. And he wasn't wrong, right? That we've lost the connection that we have to our communities. We don't have the bridging social capital that we used to have. You know, we spend more time with people like us and less time with people who are different from us than we used to. And that has real consequences for who we trust, whether we trust the decisions made by the government, and whether, in fact, we even believe that the government and those decisions are legitimate. You know, so there's a lot of research about this, but, you know, again, it happens within, you know, the sort of context of, you know, a increase of polarization that's driven by political parties, you know, at the same time as a for-profit media system is threatened and a new, you know, sort of online media ecosystem emerges that's also, of course, for profit. You know, and all of those things put a strain on, you know, these communal goals that we might have or we might once have had for, you know, the public sphere and the way that we could all connect and communicate with one another online.
Well, Jennifer Machia, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
It's my pleasure. Thank you.
And again, I've been speaking with Jennifer Machia, who's a professor in the Department of Communications at Texas A&M University, where she teaches courses on political communication and presidential rhetoric, an historian of American political discourse, especially discourses about citizenship, democracy, and the presidency. She's the co-founder of The Rhetoric of Heroic Expectations, Establishing the Obama Presidency, and author of Founding Fictions, as well as Demagogue for President, The Rhetorical Genius of Donald Trump. And she also has an article at The Conversation, We Are All Propagandists Now. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon, and this program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org, where you can sign up for our email updates as well as subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. If you like this program, you can help us reach more listeners by taking a moment to rate and review us on iTunes, Google Play, iHeartRadio, or wherever you get your podcasts. And please do share the program with friends and family and colleagues on Twitter and Facebook. And to help us sustain our mission and spread the word to keep us corporate-free and commercial-free, we have added a donate button. So if you're in a position to give support, please take a moment to visit backgroundbriefing.org/donate, where your tax-deductible contributions will help us continue to build a reality-based community in post-truth America. And I'll be back again tomorrow with another Background Briefing. Bye for now.